This is the Lunch Bunch with Andrew Hawthorne and Company on VOCM. For the next half hour, we will peek behind the big stories we are all talking about today. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station. Now, your host of the Lunch Bunch, Andrew Hawthorne.
Hello, city. It's Andrew Hawthorne. Welcome to the Lunch Bunch. I hope you're having a very good day out there. I hope you're all shoveled out and prepared for an extremely icy Friday. That's going to be some Arctic conditions here on the island. Up in Labrador, you folks are used to this stuff. Maybe you can slip us some tips and figure out how that we lightweights down here can survive this stuff. Somebody else who's probably used to surviving Arctic conditions is my guest today, T.A. Loeffler. How are you doing today?
I'm doing just fine. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Thank you so much for coming on the show, and you're coming on the show for an extremely exciting reason. You have been named to a very special list by the Royal Canadian Geographic Society of the greatest explorers ever.
Yeah, something like that. The 90 greatest explorers who were born or have hung out a lot in Canada.
Yeah, or important to Canada. Some of them not so much Canadian, but very important to Canadian development. Champlain is on the list, so you're ranking on that level. But, you know, a few other people on the list, of course, Elon Musk, who's pushing space exploration right now. Roberta Bondar, also space exploration, but amazing. Bob Bartlett, who, as we know from high school, is the great explorer. And also T.A. Loeffler.
Yeah, I still sort of can't believe it.
What is it that makes you get up in the morning and say, well, today I'm going to go and be one of the great explorers?
I think it was a process. It definitely wasn't. I woke up one morning, and though actually if you ask my parents, they will tell you about the morning when I was three and I woke up before everyone else and made a butter and sugar sandwich and headed out. They found me about 4K from home. So it has been a lifelong pattern of wanting to go and explore my curiosity about what's around the next corner. And then 40th midlife crisis kind of set off the really big, much more extreme explorations that people more know me for.
What I want to go back to here before we get too far away from it. You said something very important there. A butter and sugar sandwich.
You know, it was the late 60s.
Okay. Wow. All right. Well, I'll try that later on.
It's surprisingly good, especially on fluffy white bread, but I didn't say that on the radio.
Okay. So, you know, you're on this list, but of course, for a lot of different reasons. I'm going to get to ask you a question I've wanted to ask for a very long time, and I'm very excited about it. Of course, one of the adventures you've done, and you've done it a couple times now, is Everest, and you've gone various levels up Everest, not quite to the top yet, but what I want to ask is, what's it like on the Khumbu Icefall?
Terrifying, yeah. Number one. It's absolutely beautiful. I often liken it to traveling through 10,000 icebergs that are piled up on a height of 6 Signal Hills. And they're as tumultuous and able to turn as our icebergs that we have here on the coast come May or June. And
the ones we tell everybody to stay off of.
To stay off of. Don't bring your boat nearby. And we have to climb beside them and climb up and over them. An ice fall, for folks that don't quite realize, is where a glacier goes over a steep drop. And so just like a rapid on a river, the ice gets broken up. It would look a lot like, you know, pack ice that's pushed up against the shore, except that it's 3,000 feet or 1,000 meters high. And you have to make your way. There's a group of Sherpas that help us out. They put in the route. They're called the Icefall Doctors. So they're putting in a hand line that's secured that you can hook into.
And ladders across the crevasses?
Ladders those are probably what people think of when they think of the Khumbu. And some of those ladders go horizontally. Some of them go vertically. And sometimes you come around the corner and they might be hanging in space because the icefall is very active. It changes every day. There's sometimes avalanches in the icefall. The ice can fall, like a ladder could be propped up and it could give way. So basically your strategy in getting through there is as quickly as possible, but you're also at well over 6,000 meters. So fast and 6,000 meters don't usually go in the same sentence.
How do you prepare for active, fast movement at 6,000 meters? Do you do a lot of breath training?
You do. I do. And many people do a lot of carrying weight, you know, so up hills. If people live in a place without hills, upstairs. So me and Signal Hill are best friends.
Okay.
Stair steppers, like you'll see folks with stair steppers, and my favorite way is to haul a tire up Signal Hill. So I'll strap on a 45-pound tire, haul it up the hill, or a couple different tires, because that makes you go really slow, and you have to work mentally with your patience, and you're breathing super hard, working super hard, but not getting anywhere fast, which is really that experience. Also, for going through the ice fall, I often have some ladders in the backyard, and I practice. I put on my big boots, I put on my crampons, and you practice all of the steps and the protection changes. So we have a series of cow's tails, we call them, with carabiners on them, and you have to click past different anchor points. And that's one way to get faster. Like me, I'm 5 foot nothing. So if I'm climbing with folks that are 6 feet, they're naturally going to just move faster. So I can get faster by being faster with my equipment, faster with my clips, better at taking care of myself, that kind of stuff.
Just knowing your stuff there. And is it true that, so, you know, part of the ice fall is like a vast frozen waterfall, essentially, of this glacier. And you have to climb basically straight up this massive thing that's completely vertical, like climbing up the side of a skyscraper, and you just kind of build a tent halfway up and sleep there halfway up this thing on a sheer face.
People don't usually sleep in the ice fall, because okay, that'd be kind of like walking in St. John's right now. We do sleep though in the middle of the Lhotse face. So
that's what I'm thinking.
That's what you're thinking of. So yeah, the Lhotse face, big, steep, another 3,000 foot, 1,000 meter climb, sheer blue, hard, cold ice, and you basically have to shovel out a flat spot, kind of like getting your parking spot out, and then, yeah, there's tents there. The tents are literally tied to the mountain, to the ice.
Just hanging in a tent in space.
Yeah, I mean, there is the ice that you've chipped out underneath, but if you drop your water bottle, it's going back to camp too.
See, I'm afraid to be on the top bunk in a bunk bed because I'm just going to roll out, and you're just hanging off this cliff face. How do you... Do you just, like, look out over the incredible view and you're fine, or...?
Yeah. I mean, the view is absolutely stellar, and that's one of the reasons that I love to climb so high, is the views that I get to see along the way. And for me, fortunately, you know, heights don't bother me so much. Telephones, on the other hand, I'm quite phobic about, so I'd rather sleep in a tent on this Lhotse face than make a phone call.
What makes you phobic of telephone calls? Is it that it's very annoying to use, or is it that there's all kinds of creepy germs on there?
Not the creepy germs. It's one of those weird things that, you know, basically it takes a lot of effort and making decisions that I'm going to make a cold call. I mean, I could probably, you know, I can call friends, but making cold calls, not my specialty.
Not very good. Well, I'm really good at that. Hopefully I'll get my name on a list somewhere. In the meantime, we're going to take a quick break. T.A. Loeffler, she's pulling tires up Signal Hill. I can't even get tires up Signal Hill when they're attached to my car half the time this time of year. Stay tuned. We're going to be talking to her when we get back on The Lunch Bunch.
Now back to Andrew Hawthorne and The Lunch Bunch on VOCM.
We're back. I am speaking with educator, mountaineer, and adventurer T.A. Loeffler, who was just recognized by the Royal Canadian Geographic Society alongside other inspirational explorers and things. We were talking a bit about this before the show. Which of these explorers or other explorers really inspire you? As a journalist, I'm always very inspired by Nellie Bly. She's one of my heroes, you know, the inventor of investigative journalism in a way. She committed herself to an asylum in New York to report from the inside out, went on a race around the world in 80 days. You're on a list with all of these historic people. Like, which of those inspire you?
Well, Sharon Wood's on the list. She's the first Canadian woman to climb Everest. And when I was in high school and in my outdoor pursuits club, just learning how to climb mountains and how to paddle canoes, I kind of, you know, had my sights turned to watching her Her Ascent and Junko Tobai. She's not on that list. She's Japanese, but she's first woman to summit Everest. Roberta Bondar. Jill Heinarth is there. She's a pretty amazing cave diver who spends quite a bit of time here in the province. And Mina Benson Hubbard. So she did an amazing expedition in 1905 through Labrador and Quebec. And I've always wanted to retrace her route. I've done a little bit of academic study about her. So
Tell us about her. Who is Mina Hubbard?
So Mina was married to her husband, Leonidas, and he went on an expedition in 1903 that didn't turn out so well. They took a wrong turn, went up the Susan instead of the Nisqually River, and ended up running out of food and having a really tough summer, and unfortunately he did not return. One of his tripmates wrote a book about it. Some of us probably have read it, The Lure of the Labrador Wild, and Mina wasn't too pleased with how he portrayed her husband. So 2 years later, she wanted to finish her husband's expedition, and so she found some guides and made it happen. In 1905, pretty unusual thing for a woman to go out into the wilderness, accompanied by male guides. And she did a lot of mapping of that particular part of the world, met with several indigenous folks and learned about their way of life, and ended up, long story short, beating Dylan Wallace to the end.
Nuts to you, Dylan. And so you're thinking about retracing her steps in Labrador, hey?
Absolutely. It's a little bit trickier now because with some hydro developments, her route doesn't quite exist anymore, but there's ways to kind of work around that. And I've done several canoeing expeditions in Labrador and love any time I spend out on the big land. So at one point, I was all set to go and unfortunately got injured, so I wasn't able to go then. So it's just taking a couple more times of getting it going, trying to get our team together to go and paddle from either right from Northwest River or from the Haida land and onto the George River and on up.
That's something else, too, because I think especially in North America and especially in Canada and especially again in Newfoundland and Labrador, it's very easy to look away and say, look at the amazing adventure in Nepal. Look at the amazing adventure here. But we have incredible opportunity for that, especially outdoor adventure right here in the province that you're taking advantage of.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we have folks coming from all over the world to enjoy our setting for, you know, the East Coast Trail and to paddle. We have world-class sea kayaking here in both Newfoundland and Labrador. And we have a lot of wonderful remote wilderness that is still there to be explored. So, indeed, I'm a big fan of what I call pocket adventures or near adventures, and then further afield as well. I mean, I love going up into Pippi Park a couple times a week on my skis, and there's so many interesting trails up there with the fat bikers up there now and the folks walking and walking their dogs. And I find myself in new little trails. I'm always mapping it with my GPS, and I just... My fundamental question, I think, in life is, will it go? I.e., can I get from here to there, usually human-powered, and what kind of trouble and mess can I get into between here and there? And it's like, what's around that corner? What's my curiosity? And I think, ideally, we all find that thing that we're curious about. And I'm not thinking that everyone's going to go spend 30 days in a tent or climb to the world's highest peak, but I really, truly hope that folks have things that they are curious about, you know, the arts, theater, community service, politics. Is there something that sort of, you know, makes that little extra kick in our step that gets us excited, it gets us jazzed to learn and to give back?
on that note, maybe let's go to the break. I've got so many other questions I want to ask you, but I think I'll save them for a moment. We're going to take a quick break. When we get back, we're speaking with T.A. Loeffler here on VOCM Lunch Bunch. Stay tuned, folks.
Now back to Andrew Hawthorne and the Lunch Bunch on VOCM.
We're back. I'm speaking with adventurer T.A. Loeffler, and most recently during the state of emergency, you had some incredibly useful mountaineering advice that we can apply to every day that really took off, which was to use a handsaw to hack through the ice, especially when clearing out your local fire hydrant. So I wanted to throw out there, is there any other skill or advice that you've learned from extreme adventuring all over the place that we can just apply to our everyday here?
Well, we heard on the weather forecast that we've got some cold weather coming.
Sure do.
And When I'm teaching my students in winter, they get to have the experience of sleeping in a snowball in a kind of a winter shelter called a quinsy, which is basically you mound up snow and then you dig out the inside. From the outside, it might look a little like an igloo shelter, but it's built in a very different way. But
you're just kind of creating a drift.
You create the drift. You could also just dig into a safe drift that existed. But in our case, we pile it up and then they dig it out and they get kind of cold and they're always worried about the night and then they climb in and it's reasonably warm in there. So we're going to have minus 15 overnight Friday night. If you were to build a quinsy inside and you got in there with a couple of friends and had a card game, it would be up around freezing inside. So snow is actually a great insulator. So I lose my plumbing most winters when it gets super cold, like it's going to. So I use snow. So just like I would pile a snow wall against around a tent to protect it from the wind, I will pile snow up against the area of my house where if it's not piled up, I'll lose the water.
The pipes are going to freeze.
Yeah, because we have some pipes that are close to the surface. So if you know that you lose the water, you can, if you know where that is, you can pile up the snow and it'll actually keep it a little bit warmer than if you just leave it open to the wind.
Well, there you go. Would you recommend building a quinsy as a Valentine's Day activity? You can get your special someone and get out there with a couple shovels and...
You know, it would definitely be a nice place to have some hot chocolate and and get out of the wind. We definitely saw a lot of wonderful snow forts during Snowmageddon and people putting their digging skills to use.
Sometimes right outside their front door.
Right outside their front door. It's always important never to dig into a plow berm.
You don't want to do that.
You don't want to do that, but if you've piled the snow yourself, always, leave some ventilation I'd spend Valentine's Day in a quinsy.
That sounds like a really great time to me.
You know, ice hotel, think of Quebec and Sweden. People, spend quite a bit of money to go spend a night, and here you could do it in your backyard.
Or your front yard, but not on the side of the road.
But not on the side of the road. That's not good.
The snow clearing. My entire CD collection was once in a snowdrift. I was looking for it all winter, and I discovered it sprinkled liberally over my neighbor's lawn in the spring and never got over it. My collection of Bare Naked Ladies never recovered, so that's too bad. I really wanted to ask you this. We've only got a few minutes left, but you were talking about making a relationship with the land before. And I wanted you to expand on that a bit, and we'll see where we go, because I think that's important. As opposed to going somewhere, I'm halfway well-traveled. And there is a trap you can end up in being a very surface-level visitor to a place. And you're a great proponent of trying to avoid that, I think.
Yeah, I think, you can be a collector of experience or you can sort of be a liver of experience. And for me, it's really important to have that relationship with the landscape and also the folks that live with that landscape much more so than I do. So I often like to almost pre-travel and make relationships. So we paddled the Mackenzie, Athabasca, and Slave Rivers from Jasper to Tuktoyaktuk in the summer of 2018. And we made a few visits to some of the communities ahead of time to make some connections with folks that live there, and then it was almost like reunions that we had as we went, and also learning about the plants, the flora and the fauna and the history of the places that we travel make the travel deeper for me and add to making that richness of something I call living the map. And whenever I'm planning an expedition, I'm looking at the map and you're trying to learn what you can from looking at a 2D object. But then once you've traveled through it, especially for me, when I've traveled through it slower, walking or paddling under my own power, the map takes on all new meanings. I know what's at that corner and I know it's around there and I know what I saw and felt along the way. So my relationship to that map, to that paper object, has changed through my relationship of moving through it. So I like that sort of deeper connection to both the folks and to the land itself.
And what is that feeling like? Because it gave me a really strong mental image when you're talking about this just now. There's the feeling you get when you go somewhere for the first time that is so much more spectacular than you thought. Whether it's a great natural vista, you're looking at a mountain, maybe from the top of the mountain, or some incredible... I felt this way when I went to Ephesus in Turkey and I saw these ancient Roman ruins, and it was just the most incredible thing. But there's something else when you see that thing the second time, and feel like you're coming back when you've taken something so big and sublime and somehow internalized that, and now it's like coming home. What is that feeling like for you when you're at home inside the sublime?
Well, I think, you know, when you talked about seeing something so big, and whether that's something that's thousands of years old that connects you to a lineage of humanity, or whether that's something so big like the continent of Antarctica, or when I skied across Greenland and we were four people in the middle of this sheet of ice, and that feeling of absolute smallness. When I did a presentation about a kayak trip off the coast of Labrador, I called it Four Specks in the Ocean. And it reminds me to not take myself too seriously, to always, you know, maintain that humility, like, because I'm humbled all the time by the landscape. I'm humbled by the weather. I'm humbled by the circumstances that have happened to me. And it reminded me of wanting to say that, you know, if I could remove any vernacular from mountaineering, it would be conquer. We never conquer a mountain. Even when we happen to be lucky enough to stand on the top, ideally, we make relationship with that mountain. We're opening ourselves to change by being on that mountain. We're smacked sometimes by that mountain, but that mountain will be there long, well beyond all of us. And so, I think it's recognizing that, you know, we affect the world and the world affects us, but we got to sort of remember that we're one of many, you know, of 7 billion specks. And ideally we go through our speckness with compassion and humanity.
T.A. Loeffler, thank you so much for being on the show today. I could talk to you all day, literally. How can people find out more? You've got a book out that everybody should go and check out.
Yeah, More Than a Mountain, One Woman's Everest, the story of my first attempt on Everest. And folks are more than invited along on all of our expeditions. You can follow along on our website, taloeffler.com, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and we love having folks come along, because sharing anything, whether it's your French fries or your expedition to Everest, makes it all the richer.
Oh man, especially your French fries.
Especially your French fries.
Thank you so much for coming in, T.A. That's been your Lunch Bunch for today. I hope you enjoyed it. Stay tuned. We're going to have a nice, fun Valentine's Day special tomorrow with Lunch Bunch. Again, at 12:30 every day on 590 VOCM. Until next time, stay tuned for On Target St. John's. My name is Andrew Hawthorne. Have a really nice Thursday, folks.